Before we start the show, we're starting an end-of-the-year fundraiser trying to reach a goal of 500 Patreon subscribers. Radio Open Source is an independent public radio show that relies on your support. Join our Patreon community, and you'll get exclusive interviews, special events, and podcasts, beginning with our breathtaking show with Amanda Palmer. Sign up at patreon.com/radioopensource. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The news in our scandal-sick USA is that a woman can complain of sexual oppression with some assurance that she'll be heard. Toxic maleness is a firing offense for a change. The women saying no or me too are the person of the year on Time's cover. Silence breakers marking a swerve in our culture. Next question, how masculinity itself went toxic, certified by NFL brutality and SNL humor. And for boys becoming men today, is the poison on our screens or in our genes, really? How about the outlandish privileges we let power and celebrity lavish on themselves? How about the protected standing of men? Going back to Adam and Eve, he ate the forbidden apple, of course, but she took the punishment for tempting the poor guy. When scandal value is worn out, what will men have learned? What will we have done about ourselves? Our keynote at Gloria White Hammond comes at this crisis with Christian insight. No story untold is one of your goals. You're a medical doctor, a pediatrician, an ordained minister, co-founder with your husband Ray of the Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Jamaica Plain. You're a silence breaker yourself. You've spoken and preached about sexual abuse that you suffered at home growing up. Also in your mother's experience, your grandmother's too. I know you as a studious listener to stories that everybody, everyday people want to share. What are you hearing? What do women in your church think is happening? Why was it okay for so long?
Yeah, Chris, I've been listening to these stories now for decades. And as you indicated, I'm a victim of childhood sexual abuse, which I repressed until our oldest daughter, Mariama, from whom we'll hear, was a couple of weeks old. And I noted just how uncomfortable I was when men held her or even when her dad kissed her. And over the next couple of weeks, I started unearthing those memories of childhood sexual abuse and confronted my father. And I've been talking about it ever since, and it's been very important to me to create a safe space for women to share their stories. And over these almost four decades, I have heard so many stories from women, stories of, like mine, childhood sexual abuse, date rape, victims of domestic violence, women who were trafficked as slaves, just so many stories over these decades. And so this, for me, is the most exciting development that I have seen in decades, the fact that there is this hashtag MeToo movement, that women are coming out. And what I've found over the years is that women are most encouraged. If you tell your story, they tell theirs. And so
And what do they say? And who done it? Is it in family? Is it strangers? Their guys?
It's all of that. It's typically in families, it's someone we know. It's not a stranger. It's people that I go out and that I date, or people that at
Is
my
it
job.
Workplace?
Absolutely, at the workplace. Unconscionable stories. I've had as a pediatrician, I've always asked for years, are you worried about sexual abuse? And I've had mothers respond to that by breaking down, by telling me about a situation that they experienced growing up or a situation that they're experiencing at home. Do you feel safe at home? Mm. So much of it is simply asking the question, pausing long enough to ask the question, and then be ready to listen for the response. These stories are rampant.
How strange is it that your new church building in Forest Hills was St. Vincent's Catholic Church back in the day, Forest Hills, in the time of Father Jack Gagan, the poster pedophile priest in the notorious scandal of the 90s, the ghost in those stones, Gloria.
Absolutely. So, yes, we bought the old St. Andrew's campus, and when we recognized that it was that it was a place that Jack Gagan served as priest, and some of the earliest disclosers of the sexual abuse were boys who were at St. Andrews. So we went into St. Andrews knowing that part of our work was to redeem what was also a very rich legacy of a vibrant community. So we've, as a congregation, been deeply committed to this issue of sexual victimization. We've had a ministry that we call Shatter the Silence, and much of our work is to raise awareness. But what we've been doing most recently, I think, is even more important. We've been looking at the ways of thinking and doing that inform the culture that have helped to create the systems and prop up the systems that make sexual violence, sexual victimization, harassment, assault okay.
What do you mean by that? In the culture, stories, histories?
We've especially been looking at scripture. Because we recognize that the first place that we need to deal with this issue is in churches. So we've been looking at texts, what stories of women get told, what stories don't get told, what are the patterns? One of the earliest patterns that we'll see in text is the story of Eve. And the traditional, or the way this works is that you have man and woman. Is said to tempt man. Man succumbs to the temptation. Woman gets punished as the perpetrator. Man gets excused as the victim. Well, that's a theme that we see in texts with Eve. We've seen it with Bathsheba. But we also see
Mary Magdalene, maybe.
Absolutely.
The woman taken in adultery.
That's exactly right. And we hear reverberations of these in the culture. Well, was it something that you had on? Well, where were you at the time? Again, with the assumption that these men who are also very powerful are now becoming victims, and therefore being excused for the violence that they perpetrate.
What's so extraordinary about you, Gloria, is that you speak of an opportunity here. I'm wondering. Yes. I mean, be real. Who is finding relief in this moment?
The victims are definitely finding relief because they are discovering that they are not alone and that there is a place now where they can tell these stories, and these stories are being perceived as credible, and the perpetrators are being held accountable. That is absolutely astounding because for so often, again, we've excused these perpetrators.
In your congregation, they're being held accountable.
They are. And one of the things that we've always said in terms, and I'm very interested in getting at this in terms of communities of faith, I've said that the tragedy of the Catholic clergy's sexual abuse, it was a tragedy, period. But I kept expecting it to get beyond the Catholic Church and to get into other congregations, other denominations. It never went there. And so it's been a really important thing for us. And
What stopped it? What contained it?
I think that it was easy for people to point fingers at them. And so people remain silent. They've always remained silent about what's happening in communities of faith and the extent to which typically men with power take advantage of women and girls who feel powerless. So there's always been a silence around that. But we were so quick to point the finger at that Catholic Church and to keep all the attention on the church and remain silent about other churches, other denominations, synagogues, mosques, where this also happens.
In your own church, Gloria White Hammond, you've spoken about looking out at your congregation and knowing statistically and maybe from conversations that there are victims.
There are
numbers of them, and there are perps out there too.
Absolutely.
How does that feel?
Well, it feels. I've always said that there. I go back to these yellow pages, and years ago when we had the yellow pages, there was
sure.
this. They had this logo: "What's out there is in here."
Right.
And it's the same thing in terms of the church. There are perpetrators out there, and there are perpetrators inside our communities of faith. So we have always made it clear that we know you're here. Mm-hmm. And it's important. This is one place where there needs to be redemption for perpetrators, and we do have some perpetrators in our congregation. So we believe in redemption after accountability. So
prison probably.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yes. There. You will find Jesus in jail. Jesus makes stops in jail, and you need to be there. So you have to be held accountable. So redemption comes in the context of accountability, absolutely.
And what about things short of the explicitly, convictably criminal?
Then we still want to talk about that and still want to hold you accountable around that. So that is also a message.
How does that work? For a man who is verbally abusive or absent or, you know, adulterous or whatever?
Well, once you're identified, certainly we have a very committed core group of men who are committed to working through that with you. Absolutely. So we're not one of those churches where when there's clearly domestic abuse going on, that we're going to send that wife back to that husband. Oh, no, we're going to make sure that you're safe, and we're going to deal with him as well.
The women who speak to you, Gloria, what do they see coming out of this? What is their hope for themselves, for the culture, for us, all of us, for their men?
There is a hope that finally their situations will be redressed, that finally they will be heard. And then that even beyond that, that we'll begin to address the need for a cultural change, to really identify the drivers again, not just the prevalence, but what are the drivers, what are the ways of thinking, and that we make every effort to change those.
You have a pretty good idea of what the drivers are? We'll come back to that.
Sure.
Good. Coming up, the 30-something daughter's version of the White Hammond Ministry. Reverend Mariama White Hammond is her mother's student, now partner in Activist Listening. This is Open Source. In church, Mariama White Hammond is a student of international relations first, then theology, hip-hop, environmental justice, and now she's an associate minister at the church her parents built, Bethel AME in Jamaica Plain, part of Boston. Mariama, what does the young preacher hear that her mother doesn't?
I don't know if there's anything that's totally that she doesn't hear, but I mean, I think there are some perspectives that, you know, I think, you know, my generation might have. So, I mean, the first thing that I would say I completely agree with is that there are so many stories. In fact, I don't know of a woman who could not tell you a story of some kind of harassment that they've experienced. Even when I'm wearing a collar, I have men catcall me in the street. And you would think like, oh, maybe you'll be afraid that you're going to go to hell. Apparently not. you know, even in all black in a collar, I still experience like inappropriate, you know, advances, all sorts of a thing. So the part of what is challenging for me is sometimes in the way I've seen this covered, even with women on television, there seems to be this like notion that people are surprised. We don't know where this came from. I think I'm surprised that it's gotten the level of coverage and people, it's become so widespread that people are coming out. But I am not at all surprised about the stories, because I've been hearing them all my life.
Tell us one of them in the last month, say, people who want to talk with you and share something.
Yeah, I mean, I think Gosh, I mean, I can think of so many.
Just one.
You know, I think of a young woman that I knew in my work, and the challenge of, you know, being in a situation where her mother's boyfriend was abusing her, and the journey that had to happen for that mother and daughter to get to the point where they could have the conversation, and the daughter, actually in this case, eventually the mom did put him out, but there was this whole question of whether my mom will actually stand with me on this. And, you know, I talked with her, and this has been a period of, like, hoping that the kind of struggle that she went through is not something that more women, so many women, struggle around. Will I be believed? Will the people who I want to stand up for me and stand with me do so, or will they try to sweep it under the rug? So I think it's a powerful moment, but I'm surprised by some of the women who seem shocked. I also, you know, some of the indignation I find a little challenging because some of these people, I don't believe that everybody didn't know, right? You know, I love Charlie Rose's show, and it's great. You're telling me after decades of being there, all of the allegations that are coming out, nobody knew? I mean, come on. If any of us have worked at a job, those kinds of things, everybody knows. They're not secrets. And so I think the challenge for me is, you ask this question of, like, who's to blame and who is responsible? Yes, there are perpetrators that are specifically responsible for their behavior, but all of us are responsible because many of us knew before this moment and we stayed silent.
Mariama, if you could target a generation, maybe even younger than you, maybe teenagers today or younger still, where would you want to register?
Well, I think one of the pieces, and that I'm really hoping that we get here, is this question of toxic masculinity. I think the 1970s and even before, you had the women's movement, and it created space for us to redefine what it means to be a woman. But in order for that to happen, I think we also need a redefinition of what it is to be a man. And there hasn't really been that, right? And so there's lots of things about what we consider masculine that I think are in and of themselves pretty problematic and breed this kind of behavior.
How do you spot it?
You know, I mean, I think it gets, it's all across the board. I mean, I actually had a good loving argument with a friend of mine, right? About the whole sort of, even down to men opening the doors. How do we have a conversation about where some of that stuff comes from and whether or not we want to maintain it? I want people to be polite. Love it. Don't want to knock that. But I do, the notion that I can't open a door, that my arms are strong enough to open, you know what I mean? So I think even in some of our dating relationships, I remember in college there were jokes around guys who were, you know, too soft, right? And this is from my friends who are, you know, feminists, right? So there's a deeper question about what it should mean to be a man that I just don't think we're asking.
It's all being renegotiated. I want to introduce the historian Danielle McGuire, who joins us from Detroit. She's got a critical backstory here from the Deep South. It's about sexual abuse and organized resistance to it that built networks that became the civil rights movement in the 1950s and before. Professor McGuire's breakthrough book in 2010 was called At the Dark End of the Street. Very short form was that Rosa Parks did not fight for her seat on the bus in Montgomery because her feet were tired. You tell the story, Danielle. The Rosa Parks story, revised.
Right. Well, the main argument in my book is that Black women's demands for bodily integrity and their testimony about sexual abuse and rape really fueled the civil rights movement. And you can see it across most major civil rights campaigns. The easiest one to talk about is the Montgomery bus boycott. We all know Rosa Parks. And whenever I ask people, you know, what was it that made Rosa Parks refuse to give up her seat that day in 1955, they all say, almost uniformly, well, she was tired. Well, she wasn't tired. She was tired of being mistreated. She was tired of white supremacy. She was tired of injustice. But one of the things she was specifically tired of was of black women being mistreated on the buses. And the buses were sites of violence. Rosa Parks was a militant activist who had been active in the black radical freedom struggle since Scottsboro in the 1930s. And she was active in the NAACP since 1943. And in 1944, she was their main detective. And what that meant was that she was sent out by the NAACP across the state of Alabama to investigate crimes of racial violence, but also to look into crimes of sexualized racial violence. So she investigated rape cases, beginning with the case of Recy Taylor in 1944, and a series of rape cases in and around Montgomery up into the early 1950s. And at every one of those cases, black women and members of the sort of black radical community in and around Montgomery rallied to defend black women's bodily integrity and to protect their womanhood. And so when Rosa Parks, you know, was willing to get arrested that day, not only did she know that, you know, activists were looking for a plaintiff, she knew that there were scores of black women behind her who had been mobilized and activated by a decade of resistance to sexualized and racial violence, and that they could mobilize that network for a boycott against the buses, which were the most prominent spaces for sexualized and racial violence against
black
women.
Can I just say, it's a radical insight, your book, which I've read thoroughly and admired hugely. The civil rights movement was not about public accommodations, maybe not even about voting. It was about personal sexual security for, and bodily security, as you say, for African-American women.
Well, it's that's definitely one of the things. And part of that is that, you know, the issue of sex undergirds the entire edifice of segregation all the way back to slavery.
You quote the great Swedish anthropologist Gunnar Myrdal concluding about the Jim Crow South that in this oppressive iron triangle of race, power, and sex, the key was sex. What did he mean?
Right. So I think what he means, and I think what is important for us to remember, is that restrictions on sex and marriage were at the heart of slavery and at the heart of Jim Crow. I mean, we can't forget that 27 states banned interracial marriage until the 1960s in the United States. And that ban was rooted in the very earliest days of America in the 1600s. And its design was really about maintaining the wealth and property and power of white men. So black women, enslaved women, had not only productive value for the work they could do as slaves, but also reproductive value, so that any child they bore, mostly to their masters, but to anyone else, became slaves, thus increasing their masters' political, social, and economic power. The ban on marriage also denied them the kind of protection that comes with a state and legal arrangement, right? And it denied their children inheritance and property rights, which also maintained white men's political power. But it also trapped white women in a way, because it limited white women's sexual and marital choices, and it bound them to the white men who were, in many ways, raping black women. And it kind of gave them a stake in white supremacy. And I really feel like we're still dealing with the legacy of this system today.
Speak of it. Speak of the legacy and make a link to the triangle of race, power, and sex today.
Sure. So the Me Too movement is amazing, and I'm so excited about it and, you know, heartbroken at the same time. But, you know, a lot of the women who are getting attention right now are the women who have privilege and have power. And the women who we're not hearing from, the women who have been silenced more than most, are women who are vulnerable in intersecting ways. Those are women of color, women who are working class and poor, women who are undocumented. And so this relates to that system. In Detroit, for example, one of the symptoms of this larger rape culture was discovered in 2009 when a member of the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office found 11,000 untested and abandoned rape kits in a warehouse. Now, those were kits that were primarily from black women and girls, and basically they were left there. right? So these are women who had been assaulted, who had reported to the police, which is, you know, not always common, and who had gone through the trauma of getting a forensic bodily exam. And then their kits were dismissed, just like they were, and discarded. And there has been an extraordinary struggle in Detroit to get those kits tested, led primarily by women, mainly Black women, in order to say, you know what, your lives matter. I think that that legacy, the discarding of Black women's bodies, of their stories, of their testimony, is a legacy of that system that was enshrined in slavery.
Stand by. Mariama and Gloria White-Hammond, does this make sense to you as a rewriting of our reimagining of our civil rights movement history?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's not either or. What I think that Dr. McGuire is doing is just unearthing another layer of what is really there. And I think that's actually a problem we struggle with in America. We want one nice, neat story, and we don't want to talk about the layers beneath it. And I think that that's kind of what we're seeing now in the rise of white supremacy and these conversations about the Confederate flag. We have a hard time facing the reality and the complexity of our past around race and around gender and the deep relationship between those two that Dr. McGuire is talking about. And so I'm excited about Me Too, and I'm asking myself, for many white women, many who have, you know, voted for a president who's been highly inappropriate around this issue, but who also has courted white supremacists. Can we, as America, take this as an opportunity to really pull back the layers? And I think that what Dr. McGuire is naming is that this is an issue of power. We've got some real things we need to talk about in terms of power. And the fact that we often promote a model of power over that you're most powerful when you have the most people underneath you. And that's not just in gender, but it is certainly heavily prevalent in gender.
Gloria White-Hammond, are you hearing a new civil rights narrative here?
Well, it certainly is not new to me, but and I appreciate Dr. McGuire really lifting this up, and you're highlighting it as well. No, it certainly is not new for me to recognize the extent to which there are gender inequities even in the civil rights movement that persist. Right, they persist even in 2017. So, Mari's right. This is way more complex than that. But it still is undergirded by this power dynamic that says that certain people will have power over other people. And it's very common. It's men over women. It's white over Black. It's rich over poor. So this is, again, an opportunity. What I hope is that we don't get focused on one aspect of the power dynamic and miss what's happening to women as well. And so get so focused on the race issue that we end up missing the broader conversation around women as well.
I'm not sure just what you mean, but it's obvious that we love to talk of sex as pleasure or as eros or something romantic. And so often it is strictly about who's calling the shots here.
It absolutely is.
I want to ask Danielle McGuire, how would you rewrite the textbooks around Rosa Parks and the civil rights movement?
Well, I think we just need to put women at the center where they belong. So many of these movements were led by women, were organized by women, were fueled by women's resources that, you know, and I think the civil rights literature has done a fairly good job at that. It's just that textbooks don't recognize that. Textbooks are still heavily male-dominated, reflecting the gender politics of the 1950s and 1960s, with a focus on leaders as opposed to foot soldiers. If we want to change the movement, I think what we're seeing now is that the voices of many are really important to change the culture. And the civil rights movement in many ways was a movement of many and a movement of movements. And so I think that those lessons from the past can help us be empowered to make change today.
Apply that, Mariama, to the realities of political action activism in this movement today.
Well, I think part of what this is also about is pushing back on the notion that there's normal behavior and abnormal behavior, right? And so one of the things I see now is like, oh, Harvey Weinstein, he's so terrible. And I'm not saying he's not. But we are now trying to take all these people and put them off in a corner as like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe. When the reality is they are – and I'm not excusing any of their behavior, but they are a reflection of who we are. And we're not willing to have the conversation. There's still so many things that happen every day in terms of, oh, you throw like a girl. There's all these things that are part of our everyday life that devalue women, right? One of the reasons Rosa Parks was not recognized is because she was a quiet person. I had the opportunity twice in my life to meet her. Because she didn't, her leadership didn't look like the traditional male sort of out front folks, she was pushed to the side on a number of occasions. She went around the country speaking, gave her money to the movement. The men went around speaking, took their check for themselves, and gave what was left over to the movement, right? That kind of willingness to have power with, I think, is more common in women and deeply devalued. So I'm not going to say women are perfect or men are terrible. What I'm saying is there's a deeper conversation that we aren't having.
I hear Danielle saying, in effect, it reminds me of something that a woman said to me first time I ever went to Russia. She said, Russia, you have to understand, is a matriarchy run by men. But that the men, and even in the civil rights movement, a lot of them were just trying to keep up with the pressure and the demands and the urgency of what their women and their wives and their daughters were telling them. Coming up, imagine that the battle is really about three things: the next generation, the workplace, and black and brown women as the canaries in the coal mine or in the fast food store. This is Open Source. Pain in a patriarchy is the theme this hour. In a real-time revolt around sex, power, and values, Kate Mann teaches ethics at Cornell. She writes philosophy. Her new book from Oxford is titled Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny. By misogyny, she means not hatred of women, but a system of thinking that secures a man's world. She calls it a logic because from the inside, it makes sense.
So I wanted to give that sense that this is a morally bankrupt system, but it's internally largely coherent, I think.
Draw us a picture. Connect the dots.
So do you know that children's book by Shel Silverstein called The Giving Tree?
Of course.
For those listeners who aren't familiar, as I wasn't being Australian, this tree, she's a female tree for reasons that will become apparent. She loves the boy more than she loves herself. And she gives him everything, her apples, her branches, her leaves. She becomes, in the end, this amputated stump. She says sorry like 11 times throughout the children's book, and he never says a word of thanks. So he grows up to be this man-child. And basically, I think that the logic of misogyny enforces a structure where women are encouraged to be giving trees or giving she's with respect to dominant and otherwise privileged men in their vicinity, and punishes them when they refuse to or fail to or appear to fail to. So it's a kind of enforcement. Let's switch the genders. Let's make it the giving he, and how about the girl gets everything? If it's not gendered, like, it shouldn't be a problem, you know? But the fact that it is such an off-the-wall suggestion says a lot about the fact that, yeah, this is a very gendered dynamic. She gives and gives and gives, and he takes. And you see through other dynamics what happens when she refuses to, which is this terrible violence or sexual harassment, sexual assault, belittling, condescension, mansplaining, just ways in which women are put down, shut up, and shot down for not adhering to those feminine-coded social roles.
Kate Mann, when you say it's a structure, A structure of what? A social structure? Is it in our genes? Is it in our brain? Is it in our history?
I think it's in our history. I think we have always lived more or less without exception in living memory in somewhat patriarchal cultures. And misogyny is the kind of system that girls and women face when they're faced with hostility and hatred and harassment that effectively serves to uphold the rules of patriarchy and uphold the social structures of patriarchy. So it's not that we haven't made progress, but precisely because we have made feminist progress, we also get backlash and resentment and punishment and an attempt to put women back in their place. So I think that what unifies misogyny is not the hatred that he harbors in his heart. It's not a property of the psychological characteristics of individuals. Rather, misogyny is something women face because they're women in a man's world, historically, a patriarchy, rather than being hated because they're represented as a woman in a man's mind. I mean, frankly, if she's a good giving tree, what's not to like?
That was Kate Mann at Cornell, Gloria White Hammond in Mariama, and Danielle McGuire in Detroit. Take that misogyny point apart. If it is a system, what holds it together so, so stubbornly, more than stubbornly?
Well, this is Danielle. I would argue that white supremacy holds it together. And it goes back to the earliest days of the founding of America and that sex, power, race triangle. We can't understand patriarchy and misogyny. It can't be separated from a structure of white supremacy. And I think that's part of the reason why all of these things are happening at once, Charleston and the Me Too movement side by side.
Mariama?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what is also, and again, I think this goes, back to this. The boy in the giving tree, at some point, he's just selfish. Like, and I think that that's the piece. And I love that book. I grew up, we read that book. But I reread it recently to a child. And as I was reading it, I was like, this child is like stunted in his integrity if he keeps doing this, right?
I polled my daughters tonight. They all hated that book.
I don't remember hating it, but I did reread it like literally about 3 weeks ago. And I said to myself, he should have learned somewhere down the line that this needs to be a regenerative system, that he needs to figure out how to take the trees, the limbs that are falling off and not cut the tree down in its entirety. I mean, so I think that part of it is the two sides of it. You create somebody who's lost far too much, but you also create somebody who's self-centered and problematic in a way that is both detrimental to that person, to the other person, but also detrimental to their own integrity. And as a spiritual leader, that's a problem.
I want to ask all three of you, why is something breaking or cracking now? Marcia Gessen in The New Yorker writes astutely, I think, about this bursting dam of anger and hurt. She's calling it a real-time sex panic, and she's looking for links to our sense of other systems collapsing, climate, our politics, maybe the chances of peace. How do we explain the moment?
Yeah, I think that certainly in the U.S. we can certainly feel it, but I think there's this worldwide shifting where we're just not sure what is solid ground anymore. The assault on truth and integrity has left so many of us feeling unsure, unclear, and this magic moment where women, and I think it's you referenced Russia as being the matriarchy led by men. In fact, I would argue that the world, around the world, in many cultures, absolutely, it is women who are forming community. Whatever sense of community remains in the midst of conflict is because women are doing that. And so I would say that that's really a universal phenomenon. But there are women now who are looking at the craziness of it and saying, no more. And one of the ways that that shows up in our lives personally is, again, around gender. And women are coalescing and in the context of wanting community to survive, are ready to take this issue on.
Danielle McGuire, how do you imagine this moment being used or abused or lost?
You know, I think that no major movements happen suddenly or spontaneously. They're all rooted in a context and in a history. And so over the last decade, we've really seen a movement among women to gain attention and recognition for their voices, for speaking out. And we've seen a lot of reform in terms of prosecuting rape, in terms of listening to victims and survivors, and in places like Detroit and elsewhere, to ending the backlog of these untested rape kits, which are endemic around the country. And we had a woman run for president. And so I think, you know, this comes out of all of these things, in addition to the history of women leading these kinds of struggles. I think that any movement that asks us to use our voices as weapons is a movement that is incredibly powerful and can be a catalyst for major change. So I'm really excited about this moment. I hope that we can use our voices to make change on the local, state, and national, and even international level. I think that's happening. And so I see it as just a real positive opening and catalyst for change.
Could I say, I mean, on my agenda would be at least three or four things I can think of. Break the media fixation on rich white celebrities first.
Yes.
But move through consciousness raising towards some structures of accountability in fast food, say. Third, bending the conversation away from sex as libido and pleasure or ecstasy to sex as power. But then also figuring out how to reach boys before they discover pornography on the web. I mean, this scandal so far has been mostly stereotypical, dirty old men, powerful, overpowerful guys. But the victory will be won or lost in young men. Approach it, Gloria.
Yeah. And that, for me, is the most critical aspect of this movement. I received a text from our 11-year-old granddaughter who lives in Kinshasa. And her first text was, have watching this from a distance, the question was, Yaya, that's what she calls me, why do some men do bad things to women? And I texted back, that's a very interesting question. Let's talk. And then her next text to me immediately was, and why don't most women stand up for themselves? And so this is a moment for us to do the right thing in order that we can speak to the, unfortunately, the future victims, but also the future perpetrators, because they are our sons and our men. So these are questions that we need to tackle and respond to, and again, address, not only for justice for those of us who've been victims, and again, accountability for the perpetrators, but for the kids who are watching this and saying something doesn't feel right.
Have you had the chance, opening, to talk to boys, teenagers, even younger maybe, sort of whose minds are being formed?
Yeah, I mean, I think I actually have, and I think it's really complicated. I think they are actually trying to figure out how to process all this because I think we've sent them a lot of mixed messages. And I think the idea that people would think of you as less than a man, they still, that's kind of the worst thing that could happen to you, right? So I do think there have to be groups of men who say, you know, screw those concepts that you have of who I'm supposed to be. This is who I am going to be. And I think for us as a religious community, I think it's important for us to ask, who would God want you to be? And then be bold in that. And I don't think, you know, despite what Roy Moore says or the, you know, unfortunately, the support of many Christians for folks, I don't think that this is the kind of masculinity that, that God would want from us. And I think we need to create a space to say what is required of us. But I think it, again, goes back to this question of power. How are we living with one another? How are we loving our neighbor as ourselves? We're not doing that on so many levels. And I think you asked the question, why did it blow up now? I think people do feel this sense of, I don't know what is going on at the national level, at the international level. Things are crazy. But I do know that here in my own life, this needs to stop. And I may not be able to change the dynamics in Washington, but I am going to speak up right now and say the way I've experienced inappropriate power in my own life, I can say something about. And I'm hoping that what starts in a conversation around what women are experiencing around sexuality and sexual harassment and assault opens us up to a larger conversation about what is it, how do we treat each other with integrity in all the ways that we live? And how do we deal with some sort of the naked power on display that says integrity doesn't matter and truth doesn't matter?
You prompted me to ask a question I've just puzzled about, that we're in our public chatter, including media, we're all in a sort of moral vacuum. The ceremonies of innocence, as William Butler Yeats said a century ago, are drowned. Who can you imagine speaking again for the oldest and best, maybe most religious, but most exalted idea of our human nature, our human destiny in this context?
I don't know if we need one voice.
Of course not.
I think what we do need is people to have the permission to sit with each other and start to have this conversation. Because the truth is, I think there are thousands of women, thousands of men, millions of people who feel this. And I think if they had the time to sit down with each other and really ask, who do we want to be? I think many of us agree that we don't like what we see. And I want to hesitate to say we are looking for an anointed leader.
Not a leader, but somebody who we recognize as a moral authority. Danielle, what do you think?
Well, I just think that in a lot of these situations, you know, women have become much braver in speaking out and testifying about their experiences. But I'm also hoping that we start to ask men to take accountability, to not only listen to women's testimonies and believe us, but to take the lead in working on changing the culture among men. Men need to be leaders in having these conversations with boys and with their peers and their colleagues, and they need to stand up when they see things that are wrong. They need to have some kind of moral backbone. It's not just up to us. We can't change it by ourselves. We can speak out, we can stand up, we can shout from the rooftops, we can make a movement, but we can't change the culture until men get on board and do a lot of the work, because a lot of the problem is with, in many ways, their behavior, their ideals, their morals, or lack thereof.
Let me ask Gloria Hammond. President Obama loved Dr. King's line that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Have you seen it work that way? And do you believe it does?
I do believe it does. And the challenge is to... Two challenges. One is to trust the process and to know that it's my responsibility to in my lifetime to be an agent that helps that arc to bend. And the message of the civil rights movement and every movement is that I may not see it in my lifetime, but I will know that I contributed to that realization of justice. And my hope is that I raised two warrior women daughters who are going to continue to carry this forward. And what is clear to me is now I have an 11-year-old granddaughter, and I may not see it fully in my lifetime, but it will be seen. And what this moment is in terms of the hashtag MeToo. At some point, something's going to crack, and that's going to be, and my daughters and my granddaughters will be equipped to step in and make the change.
Thank you, Gloria White-Hammond, and Mariama White-Hammond, and Ray Hammond in absence. I got to say, I love visiting your church. Thank you, Danielle McGuire and Kate Mann. Listeners, please show your support for Open Source at the end of this year. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/radioopensource and help support the hardest working team in radio. Sign up and you'll get exclusive content, special events, podcasts, interviews, and such, including our podcast with Amanda Palmer last week. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, and George Hicks. Feminists all, and by the strong women, Becca DiGregorio, Susan Coyne, and Mary McGrath. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.